Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now then, our next guest has represented Ireland at the Paralympics in Rio in 2016. He's been to World Championships, European Championships. He is also an Irish Heart Foundation ambassador. He's recently retired, and we're delighted he's popped into studio. Paul Keoghan, you're very welcome.
Thanks a million for having me. It's a pleasure to be here to talk to you today.
No, it's great to have you with us. So, well, you've an extraordinary story by any measure, really. So for people who may be unfamiliar with you and your background, we might give them the potted history and you can take us in whatever direction you want to go in. Up until the age of 15, 16, I guess, to be more specific, playing your football and your soccer in Meath, fairly normal, active kind of childhood. That was the general picture.
Yeah, I suppose like a lot of teenagers, I would have been playing sports nearly every day, or I would have been playing either Gaelic football or I would have been playing soccer, and I was really, really sporty. And I started playing with the juniors in my club when I was 16. And you know yourself, on a junior team, like, it's like there tends to be a few young lads. Like, I was only 16, and then there tends to be a lot of lads maybe like that are a lot older, say in their mid-30s.
Or the lads who hate the fast 16-year-olds.
Yeah, exactly. And there's such a difference there in strength. Like, I got an elbow in the temple. And playing football. It was my second game with the juniors, and I remember, like, there was nothing malicious in it. It was just, you know, like, it's football, and like in sports you get collisions. And I just started getting a really bad headache, and I just passed out on the pitch, and I was unconscious, and they couldn't find a pulse, and, like, you know, it seemed really serious. And what happened was I had a brain hemorrhage. So, I mean, obviously there's severe risk of, like, that I was going to pass away or that I was going to have severe brain damage. But luckily, I actually only spent 10 days in hospital from that, recovered really well.
I was reading that when you collapse on the pitch, obviously it's difficult for people to know exactly what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
And people understandably were thinking, well, do we give CPR? And there was a physio there who realised, somehow she realised what was going on and knew that CPR would have been the worst thing for you, because you're pushing blood into the brain when that's the last thing you want to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Her name is Lily Fox, actually. I always mention her because she had seen a jockey having a brain hemorrhage, I think, a few years previous to that. And she was brave enough to make the call to say that she thought I was having a brain hemorrhage. So she knew, put me in a recovery position, and just leave me be, like, you know. So it was a really brave call on her part.
And is a brain hemorrhage basically the vein bursts?
Yeah, it's just internal bleeding. So my vein was bleeding. It's like a bruise, except obviously it's internal bleeding in your brain, which is obviously a lot more serious. And then, so like I was less than 2 weeks in Beaumont. Like, I recovered really well from that.
Yeah.
And then they found that I had an aneurysm, which basically meant the vein was bruised. Now, I'm not a doctor, so these aren't, like, medical. This is just my understanding of it, is that the vein is bruised, and the chances are it's going to burst again.
Okay, so you're susceptible to this happening again.
Yeah, and I know that I have family members who had aneurysms as well. So, you know, I think there's a chance that it may have been genetic, or there's a chance that it may have been caused by the original knock in the football match. And so then they decided that I needed an operation.
Okay.
And the operation was, I needed to get it. There's two now. All I know is they put a coil in the vein, basically to keep it open so it doesn't burst again.
Yeah.
And there was a 97.5% success rate with this operation. And obviously, at this stage, I had turned 17. So the younger you are, obviously, the more likely you are to like come through the operation. But unfortunately, it was during the operation that I had a stroke. So I was in the unlucky 2.5% that time.
Because, I mean, I know you're actually working in maths now, you're giving maths grinds, and we'll talk about your life now, I suppose. But 2.5%, I mean, I'm no Einstein, but that's, I like those odds. That's you're probably going into the operation.
Yeah.
Any operation has its risks. Were you going in, maybe blasé is too strong a word, but kind of thinking 97.5%, I'm good.
It's funny, blasé is actually the exact word to use, like, because I think I had been in the lucky 5%. With the recovery I made from the brain hemorrhage.
As in
it was a complete recovery, no brain damage whatsoever. You know, like, I only spent a few days in hospital. It was like having food poisoning. It was like, you know, it wasn't a big deal at all.
Right.
And, like, it was harder, obviously, my family and my friends. It was really scary for them. But I remember going in for brain surgery and, like, blasé is exactly the word I'd use. Like it didn't sink in at all. Like, you know, like,
it's understandable. Your odds are good. You're young. Yeah. You're healthy. The initial incident wasn't life changing. You probably thought, I'm okay here.
Yeah, I was in St. Pat's in Navan, and I was going into sixth year. And I remember, like, my motivation was I wanted to be on the senior football. I wanted to be on the football team. So this was like the first week in August.
Right.
And I was thinking, if I get this operation now, I'll be grand. I'll few weeks in hospital. I'll be back in school in September. I'll get on the senior team. And like,
life will be good again, back to normal.
Yeah, like, it was completely naive. I wasn't, you know, like, well, naive, I don't know, but maybe unrealistic. And yeah, I just felt it didn't seem like a big deal at all. Like,
so at some stage you wake up from this operation and realize your life has completely changed. What are your memories of those first few moments or those first few days when you wake up? How long are you out for after the operation?
It's funny because I always, I often do talks about this and I get people to close their eyes and visualize it and stuff. But I just remember, so I had the operation, say the right side of my head. So my right eye is swollen shut. Okay. And the right side of your brain controls the left side of your body. So basically part of my brain had died. Now again, I'm not a doctor, but as far as I understand, part of my brain was just not firing anymore. The neurons weren't firing, which meant the entire left side of my body was gone. That's the only way I can describe it, is it's like it's gone.
You couldn't feel it?
Couldn't feel it, but it's more than I wasn't aware of it. Like, even to the, over time, obviously, it's gotten a lot better, and my leg has recovered almost 100%, and my hand, I still get spasticity, say, in my hand, but...
What's spasticity?
Spasticity basically just means, like, certain muscles, like, say, the muscles here in my bicep tend to clinch a lot. Like, my natural position would be in kind of, say, like, where my arm, my bicep is really tight, and I'm clinching my wrist, and I can't describe it for radio now, but I'm sure some people can see it, but... Basically, I can actually control all the muscles. Like, say, I can, if I really think about it, I can control my triceps.
Right.
But the problem is, if I try and move my triceps, I'm going to fire my biceps like mad as well, because I don't have control over them. So, it's hard to describe. It's like, I can do any movement, but it's not smooth. Do you know, like, if I decide, right, I want to fire my tricep right now, I'll actually just fire everything. Every muscle in my arm will just fire. So it'll just be like, I will be moving my tricep, but it won't do anything because everything else is firing as well.
So you don't have very specific, delicate control over little
I don't have selective, say, control, but I can...
So if you want to fire your tricep or your bicep, do you just tell your brain, everything left side, let's go at it?
Well, I don't mean to. Like,
that's,
you know,
what happens.
Obviously, like, if my right hand, I can just lift my index finger, no bother.
Yeah.
But I try and do that with my other hand, and I'm just, all my fingers are after clinching. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, I did the same thing, but now all my fingers have clinched. Do you know what I mean?
Your brain sent exactly the same message. I want to move my index finger. And your whole, I saw it there.
But it feels,
it looked like you almost went to clinch your fist.
Yeah, it feels like just a blunt, like my brain just goes, okay, just clinch everything. Just all the muscles fire, which... So, but it's funny, like, if you threw a football at me, my instincts, I'd catch it, my hand would open fully. I have that instinct.
Even your left hand?
Even my left hand would open fully. Like, if you fired a football at me, it's going to hit me in the face.
Yeah.
I could no bother protect myself.
Right, but it's when you want to consciously send a message.
Yeah, but instinctually, because I actually have the movement.
Yeah.
But I just can't consciously control it.
Okay. So you have moments then where your left side, specifically your hand, will react instinctively in a very good way.
Yeah.
Like if someone throws a ball at you.
Yeah.
But then if you're sitting here and we're chatting and I say to you, tap your index finger twice, it'll look like everything's
A whole lot, yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly.
So back to, you're in the hospital bed, you wake up, your eye's swollen. It's like your left hand side has disappeared.
Yeah, I couldn't open my left eyelid and my right eye was swollen shut.
Yeah.
And like, obviously, I was on a lot of painkillers, so I would have been quite drowsy. But I do remember breathing out of a ventilator. So, you know, I could feel, say, a tube in the back of my throat, which it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I remember trying to pull at this. And now, this is going to sound like a lie, but genuinely what they did was they put a boxing glove on my hand to stop me from pulling these tubes out. Yeah. So you can imagine my parents came in, I'm there in all these tubes and I'm after having a stroke and I have a boxing glove in my hand, so they couldn't figure that one out. But I remember being there and I remember that feeling, and I remember, like, I started pointing, I started like
Hitting your left side.
Hitting my other side to try and figure out what was going on.
Yeah.
But really the only thing I had full movement, the only limb that seemed to be working from my perception was my right leg. Mm. I remember just kicking my right leg and trying to get attention kind of thing, like, you know, just to let people know.
If I'm in your position there, I think I start screaming out loud. I'm like, what is going on? Quick, tell me.
I definitely, yeah. Like, now in fairness, it sounds terrifying, but at the same time,
It sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, but I'm on a lot of painkillers now. Do you know what I mean? So like, this is a very hazy memory.
Okay.
Do you know? It'd be like the memory of like a night out or something where you kind of like, it's like, that's a terrifying. I didn't really perceive what was going on.
What's your first clear memory of being told what is dreadful news?
Yeah, like that's the scary thing. Like they just, when you have a stroke, it's, doctors can't tell you. Like it's very hard for them to know what kind of a recovery you're going to make. So like obviously they need to be relatively bleak, I think, just because they can't be too optimistic. They can't give you a false sense of security or what's the phrase I'm looking for? A sense of false hope.
Yeah.
But like I remember, like I was told I wouldn't have the attention span for my Leaving Cert, because you know it's not only physical, the chances were there was cognitive deficits there as well. Now luckily I'm so lucky, because I think that's another kettle of fish entirely, I'm very lucky that cognitively I never actually lost, like I was very tired for maybe a year or two after the stroke, but luckily it was all physical, all of the side effects were, say, physical.
Yeah.
And then it was the same, like at the time when after my stroke I had no feeling, it was like it wasn't there, and they couldn't tell me whether I would ever come back or not. So
that's devastating. I mean,
it's terrifying.
Well,
yeah,
you're 17 years old, yeah. You're getting that news.
Did
you bawl cry for a couple of days?
Like I said, I went in blasé, and when I got those news, I think as well, it didn't sink in. I'd say it was surreal. I don't ever remember feeling sorry for myself, or I don't ever remember looking in the mirror thinking, oh, like, what am I going to do? Like, the only memory I have there is I remember, you know, the little pots of jelly you get in the hospital. Whenever you get them, you always get those. And I remember thinking, just sitting there thinking, this was about 2 weeks after I had the stroke, and my arm, my feeling had started to come back into my arm. And I remember thinking, I'm not going to eat any food unless I feed it to myself with my left arm. Mm. I remember just sitting there for like 5 or 6 hours trying to eat this little pot of jelly, and like, sure, it just all ended up on the floor. Like, yeah. I didn't get near it. But that's the only clear memory I have, like, which I suppose was a very good way to react.
It's a very good way to react. It was very, very possible devastation, depression would have set in. You know?
Yeah, and yeah, I don't know. I think I was naive enough that I think I was naive enough to think, oh, like, I'm gonna get over this, I'll be fine. Mm. Which at the time probably was, I didn't like appreciate the severity of the situation I was in, like, you know. But luckily I did manage to recover very well, like, you know.
Yeah, so I know you spent a couple of weeks in the rehabilitation centre at Dunleary, where I suspect you saw people far worse off than yourself. It's a very sad place in many ways, Dunleary. And, and that's where you try and literally get back on your feet?
Yeah, like it's an intensive, it's like you wake up in the morning and you're doing rehabilitation. You know, you wake up in the morning, and I had a speech and language therapist, because I never actually lost my speech, but I lost, say, the muscles in the left side of my face. It's like, you know the way you can wake up with like Bell's palsy, or basically my left side of my face was droopy. So I remember like doing exercises to try and smile. And I remember trying to learn how to wink and stuff and like that. I remember the day I got to wink, I was so proud of myself. Like, but and then you'd wake up, you do speech and language therapy, you do occupational therapy, you do physiotherapy, like, you know, and everyone there was doing it. So, you know, it was an immersive environment. It's not like, say, in the athletics, where you want to be in an immersive environment. If you're training with people who have the same goals as you, then it motivates you.
Sure.
And it was the same there. But yeah, like, it's a tough place. Like, I mean, there's a lot of motorbike accidents. People who've acquired paralysis.
I drive a motorbike, and there's people who've try to warn me off it. And
really, yeah. Well,
Dunleary, and I don't want to know. But it's a horrifically tough place. Yeah. As I understand it, the state will provide, I could be wrong here, but I remember this from the Sean Cox situation, that Liverpool fan.
Yeah, yeah.
The state might give you 2 weeks in Dunleary, and then are you on your own? Is that kind of, was that how it worked for you?
Yeah, like, well, you see, you have to get into my mindset at the time. Like, I was so utterly naive to my situation.
Okay.
Like, I'm dead. So I was in Dunleary in, say, September, and I'm 17. And all my friends are after going back to, they're in sixth year in school. And I'm like, I just want to go back to school. I want to be a normal kid again. I wanted to get out of there. Yeah. I wanted to go to school. And so, like, I was absolutely determined. And I was like, right, I needed to learn how to walk. And once I was able to walk, I was able to go to school. I'd say originally, say, my hand started coming back a little bit faster than my leg.
Okay.
I remember the first day I stood up was the day of the All-Ireland final that year, which is like 20th September, yep, around that. But I remember that, just like the All-Ireland final was on, that was the day I stood up. But you see, then once I'm on my feet, that means that all day, every day, I'm training my leg. Do you know what I mean? Whereas it's very unnatural. I wouldn't be using my arm nearly as much. Mm. Like, it's subconsciously, I would never use my left arm. You know, I do everything with my right arm. Whereas now, once I'm standing up, I'm on my feet, so I'm always working my left leg, which I think is it's a testament to why my leg has improved a lot more than my arm, say.
Okay.
But I had to get a treadmill, and it's thinking about all the little movements. There's a lot of, like, you know, I have to lift my ankle a certain way and make sure my toes, because originally, say, if I move my left leg, my little toe on my left foot would land first. So land on the left and at the front. Do you know what I mean? And
then, yes, I do.
So I had to train myself to land on my ankle, which was a matter of, you know, when you walk and you put
heel to toe.
So I was walking up and back with that, because when I went heel to toe, I had to put my heel down first and then my toe. And it was a year of walking up and down heel to toe.
Thinking it. Like. This may be a terrible analogy, so shoot it down and we'll move on. You know, sometimes if you get horrific pins and needles, and you almost can't feel your foot, and you have to really think about how you're walking. It sounds not a million miles away from that.
I've never thought about it like that, but I suppose it is a bit like that, where your limb is still there.
Yeah.
And you have the movement on it, but you can't feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose that's a very good analogy, actually. I've never thought about it like that, yeah.
Good. That's what came to mind, where sometimes you're walking with terrible pins and needles, and you can look down and see your foot's moving, but you're not getting the same sensory messages back from you almost need to just trust.
And you nearly fall over then.
So the extraordinary thing is, you go back to school and you do your Leaving Cert that year. So that's a tough year. I mean, as you said, you're very tired for a year or two.
I don't know. I honestly, looking back, I don't know how I did it. But I was very lucky in that I got access to a physio on a weekly basis when I got home.
Who pays for that?
And that was the state paid for that.
Right.
And then in an ideal world, I would have had access to an occupational therapist as well. But unfortunately, there just wasn't available.
Right.
But luckily, my parents were in a position to... We got a private OT to come once a week, so I did have access to that.
What difference does that make, do you think, over the year?
I would not be where I am today without that. Like that, what the physio taught me was it's the reason I'm able to walk. Like the physio, the reason I'm able to run, or obviously the reason I managed to get to the Paralympics, is because I could walk correctly. So that was all physio. In my mind, physio is more larger motor movements, whereas the occupational therapist would have been working on the fine, like my finger movements and the finer things in my shoulder blade and that kind of thing. And I mean, that made a massive difference as well, but I certainly needed both of them.
Okay. A tough thought, isn't it, that I mean, look, it's right across life, but a lower income household who can't afford a private occupational therapist, that person
it's just a far
inferior place, and it's just down to money.
It's a horrible thought. Like, and because that's without a doubt, it's just because I had access to that. Yeah. Like, and as well, obviously, I was sickened. Like you know, you'd be coming home from school, and the thoughts of spending an hour and a half lifting a cup up and down and up and down, it would kill me.
Miserable.
But I was lucky in that my neighbour was a nurse, and she came to the house every day for a year.
Yeah.
To make me do my exercises, or watch me doing my exercises.
Right. Wow.
Which, like, you know, at that age, if my parents had got me to do it, I would have just ended up, you know, we would have just had an argument.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have been able to say, make me do it. But if I'm in a bad mood and my neighbour comes over, I have to be nice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that she was there, like, I was lucky in that I, for that year, I got great support.
What a legend. Because no offence, Paul, but I'm sure she didn't find every moment in your company exhilarating.
Yeah, and the exercises I was doing was not exciting at all. So
lifting
yeah,
a cup, it was, small stuff. Wow.
Yeah, it was very tiny little movements.
So you do your leaving, and then to jump ahead a small bit, you did pharmacy in Trinity College, and I saw a quote from you, it was in the 42. And you said, I finished pharmacy, I kind of knew I didn't want to be a pharmacist. Everyone was like, oh, I'm so happy that we're going to start being pharmacists. And I was just thinking, what the fuck am I doing? I felt like I was just going through the motions. Go to school, go to college, get a job. I felt I needed to regain control and do something different. So look, everyone's had a bit of that in their life. Everyone's felt like, oh my God, is this it? I'm just going to get a job now. And that's me signed up. When did the thought of becoming a Paralympian come into your head? How does it come into your head?
I think the first thought would have been when in London. You know, London Paralympics were the first time that I really noticed.
They were properly on TV.
Yeah, they
made a big deal.
TV,
yeah.
Yeah. And I think it was probably then. I would have been in second. I would have been in third year in college then, starting third year. And I liked pharmacy. I really enjoyed it in college. But I kind of knew from, say, the end of second year, maybe the start of third year, I knew that it just wasn't really for me. But I've thought, well, I'll finish it now. Like, I'm halfway through. Yeah. And I'm glad I did. Like, it's great to have a degree like that, because it can obviously open other doors.
Yeah.
But I suppose it was probably then. But I didn't do anything about it. It was kind of just I always think, do you ever see Inception, you know, the movie, and Leonardo DiCaprio's like, a simple little idea can change everything, where it's like you plant a seed and it just grows and grows. And I think it was like that. Like, I'd say maybe the London Paralympics planted a little seed, and within 2 years I was like, right, I'm going to move home, I'm going to just uproot my life and start from scratch, and I'm going to be in Rio in 2016.
Wow. So like, I was a full-time, I'm not going to work, I'm just going to move home and dedicate myself to it kind of thing?
Yeah, like I went home and I had never done athletics. Like, I would have been quite athletic, but I would have been always playing team sports. But I didn't know, like, again, I was as naive about this as I was about, I'm going to recover from this stroke. You know, when I had the stroke, I definitely acted naive.
There is an ignorance as bliss quality to your journey.
Yeah, exactly.
Here.
So this is, again, I was like, this will be grand. I'll just go to the Paralympics in 2 years. This will be fine. So,
how do you pick what you're going to do? What discipline?
Probably, to be honest, from like historically, from when I was a teenager, I would have been very athletic, very fit. Okay. And so I would have thought I'd be longer distances. But by the nature of my disability, say my leg would get far too tired. So I'd say the more tired I get, obviously the more tired my brain gets. And once my brain gets tired, then I start limping. Do you know what I mean? So after a while, it wasn't feasible for me to do something like a 1500 or something like that, which I think if you rewind like pre-stroke, that would have definitely been my forte.
Okay,
yeah.
Interesting.
But so I ended up going with the 400 meters. And yeah, like I think that was the right one purely because, I mean, I was fast, but I wasn't great out of the blocks. So 100 would have been no good to me, Joe. I didn't have a quick enough start. Like.
Okay. So, I mean, like, you do it, you know, you get to Rio, which is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because that first year I missed out on the world championship. So in 2015, but it's because I had a really bad groin injury. I tore a lot of the muscles because I was running wrong. Basically, when I learned to walk at 17 on a treadmill, I was using muscles. I was using muscles in my lower back to walk. Mm-hmm. So say I wasn't using the muscles that I should have been using.
Okay.
So then when I started sprinting on that, all the muscles just tore apart basically. So I had to go back to scratch, and I went to the sports surgery clinic, you know, in Santry.
Yeah.
And it was about learning to walk
again
the right way.
Yeah.
And then once I could get that right, and I started using the right muscles, basically my hip flexors weren't, I wasn't using them at all. Once I started using them, then I could get back in and actually start running properly.
Do you get funding to compete as a Paralympian? Like, do Sport Ireland or anybody give you money?
Yeah, but at that stage, no. You have to, like, there's certain criteria, like you have to be selected for the major championship, and then depending on how you perform at the major championship each year, then you get your funding.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rio, you're disqualified. False start.
I false started in Rio. Now,
this is, I mean, like, you know, so you've worked for years to get
here. Like,
you're on the block.
They changed the rules in a few months before Rio that you're only allowed to, they changed it for Olympics and Paralympics, that you're only allowed one false start.
Yeah.
Whereas up until that, you were allowed more than one.
Yeah, because I remember Usain Bolt getting disqualified in Daegu.
And then, yeah, yeah.
And it was like, the rule's too harsh.
But yeah.
Anyway.
But they actually, so then, after a load of Paralympians false started. So they changed the rules for the Paralympics after Rio. So the only time in history when a Paralympian would have been disqualified for false starting once is Rio.
Okay.
But yeah, like I false started and it was because like I fell forward. Like I didn't actually take off. Because you know, you're putting a lot of pressure on your shoulders, you know, you're leaning forward and my left shoulder is weak. And yeah, I fell forward, and that was devastating.
Oh my God! So you're engaged, ready to go, and you can feel your shoulder getting tired. Do you know you're about to fall?
No, I didn't know, but I slipped forward, and like I didn't sprint forward, but I just slipped forward, and I just froze. It was like 30,000 people, in a stadium, just staring at me, and I was like, oh my, like that again, surreal.
Does someone kind of go, oh, we've got a false start?
Yeah, the gun, there's a different sound that like it's a false start sound. And I was like,
that's me.
I knew it was me and I just froze. And then this Brazilian lad walks over and he just grabbed me by the arm. Well, he didn't grab me, but he like chaperoned me into this tunnel. And I remember just going into the tunnel, like I was bawling my eyes out, going into the tunnel. And I remember just seeing the lads taking off in my race, the race I've been training for like 2 years. And like,
that is brutal.
And then you go into the media tunnel, you know, and then there's cameras and there's reporters and like, oh yeah, I don't fully remember that. Like I was just emotionally overwhelmed. Like that's the only way I can describe it. Like, you know,
I'm not surprised they changed that rule.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, well, like it's fair. Like it's not as if it was just on me. Like it's, if anyone false started, they were going to be disqualified.
No, but based on what you're saying in the Paralympics, surely you should get a second chance.
Yeah, well, it's certainly in, say, I'm in the cerebral palsy category, and cerebral palsy is categorized by like a lot of, you could get spasms. Do you know what I mean? Like if you get a spasm that you can't control, and then you false start and you get disqualified, like that's not. Well, anyway, they did change the rule, like,
Okay, that's devastating.
That was tough.
That still eat at you?
No, like, originally, say, right afterwards, I was just, like, I didn't know. Like, I was, for a couple of months, I was just so disillusioned with athletics. I just didn't know what, like, I didn't know. I think if I had stopped doing athletics at that point, it would have been for all the wrong reasons. But it's funny, again, so a couple of weeks after that, I went on a holiday with my friends and we climbed Mount Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
And I remember just being on the top of Kilimanjaro and just, like, I was thinking that was, you know, it was an achievement. Like, it was a class. I was like, this is great. I'm after achieving something. Mm. And then I realized that, like, what I really wanted to do was just achieve. I just wanted to challenge myself.
Do something, yeah.
And I realized then that like athletics is, I still loved athletics and I still wanted to kind of pursue athletics. And I was like, I'm still really passionate about this. So I continued on then. 2017, I went to the Worlds in London and I came fifth in the 200 in London and seventh in the 400.
Right.
And then in August this year, I came fourth in the Europeans in the 400. But like, then, like, I don't know, something has happened in, like, the last year. Like, I have a lot of other things, like, say, career-wise, I've got a lot of other things going on. And I just lost my passion. I don't know how to describe it. For the last 4 years, I've just been passionate. Like, this is what I want. I want to run fast in circles. I want to go to the Paralympics. But this year, I just lost that passion. That fire, and I realized like I can't pursue this unless my heart is 100% in it. So in September after the Europeans, I decided to retire and moving on to a new chapter in my life now.
So you're still only 25,
26,
just gone 26. Big decision to retire because there's another Paralympics not so far away that
yeah,
could be redemptive.
Yeah, and that's the thing. But I kind of feel like I was holding on purely for that redemptive. I purely was holding on for the wrong reasons. I was holding on because I wanted that redemption.
Yeah.
As opposed to because I really wanted to go.
Do it, okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yeah, I just looked in the mirror one day and I realized that I don't love it. I wasn't in love with it anymore. And I decided, you know what? And I'm like, again, I think if I had retired in 2016, I would have regretted it for my whole life. Mm. Whereas I'm glad that I'm content in the decision I've made. You know, I feel like I spent 4 years at it. I achieved probably not what I set out to achieve, but I certainly...
Something of significance, though.
Whatever I hope to gain from it, I feel like I gained that. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
And so, like, are you back with your parents still, or like, did you move out over these few years? And
no, I'm in Dublin at the moment. Okay. So I'm doing my master's in teaching in Hibernia. So that's online.
Yeah.
I'm actually finished it in 6 weeks, so I'm nearly done that now.
Secondary school teaching.
But when I originally decided to become a full-time athlete, I was doing maths tuition, say extra maths after school,
yeah,
as was my mum, and I've a few friends who do it as well. And over the last couple of years, that's been my main source of income.
Right.
And it's just built, it's just grown and grown and grown. And at this point, it's great. We've got a website now. It's gktuition.ie. I'll get that one in.
Do.
And yeah, I mean, because the Leaving Cert Maths course, it's very long. Like, teachers are doing a great job, but to do it in 2 years is incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. So a lot of students need a little bit of extra tuition. So I actually have a lot of free material on the website where, like, Leaving Cert exam questions explained.
Mm.
And say in the last 12 months, I've really been struggling to juggle athletics and doing all the maths.
Yeah.
So I decided that was probably part of the decision as well. I decided, you know what, I'm going to make the responsible decision here, and I'm going to look towards a career as opposed to focusing on the sport.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm excited about that. I'm learning. I'm not very tech savvy, so I'm kind of learning on my feet with the website. But it seems to be going well so far. So.
And clearly, the plan then is to get in as well and teach at a secondary school somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So once I qualify now in 6 weeks, then that'll be the next step.
Thing to do.
Yeah.
Is there still a shortage of maths teachers? I know, like, I mean, I did English and History in college, so I know, like, I was promptly told, if you want to become a teacher, we don't need you.
Yeah.
Science and maths were always the in-demand subjects. Is that still the case?
I'm not really sure. I'd say from my perception of it,
The ignorance is bliss theme again. It'll be fine.
Yeah, it'll be great. It'll work itself out. Yeah. You know? I'm honestly not really sure, but I would imagine that there still is a lack of maths.
Yeah.
Because not a lot of people would do just maths in college. You know, a lot of people who do maths only in college would often end up doing something other than teaching.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
You did pharmacy, so is there a maths component to that?
No. So it was, so say I'm primarily qualifying as a chemistry teacher.
Okay.
I'm a maths nerd. Like, okay. So maths is what I want to pursue, but I'm going to need extra credits. I think I have 20 credits in maths or something. I need 60. So I'm going to have to do like a course. I think there's one in Limerick where I can get extra maths credits.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But I'm looking forward to that because I like doing maths, so it'll be grand.
Hey, okay, listen, you know? That's your problem.
That's it.
God, that's amazing. Unexpected is an understatement, but what, like, an unexpected 10 years? 10 years since your accident.
Yeah, I know, yeah. And
do you ever kind of sit up and think, you know, a poxy elbow to the head in some junior GAA match in Meath, and then, like, I'm in the 2.5% in that poxy operation and screw life, this is a nuisance. Do you get those dark moments?
Like honestly, I don't know how, but like I said, I don't remember ever having that
why
moment.
Me? Like, why me moment.
Yeah. But the way I see it is, like, because I have an uncle who passed away from having a brain hemorrhage. He had a brain hemorrhage, recovered from it, and then had another one.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I see it, like, the doctor said that there was a 50-50 chance that either I was born with an aneurysm that was bound to burst,
eventually, yeah,
or I got an aneurysm from the football match.
Okay.
Okay. So if I was born with an aneurysm, having a brain hemorrhage on the elbow obviously would have burst it. And then that was when it was identified. It was a lot better to be for that to happen when there's a physio on the sideline and there's 50 or 60 people around to help me. Whereas, like, if that had happened, like, on a night out, I have a brain hemorrhage, then I'm in serious bother.
Yeah.
So either it's saved my life.
Yes.
Or it's caused me to have a disability. But, like,
it may have saved your life. That's the way to look at it, I guess.
And either way, like, I honestly think, like, I'm incredibly lucky. Like, having a stroke has only actually opened doors for me, which is, it's an amazing thing to be able to say. But again, it boils down to the fact that I had that physio, occupational therapy, speech, and I had the nurse coming to me every day. Like, because of that, it's genuinely been now, it's, I don't know if I could say beneficial, but honestly, it's genuinely improved circumstances for me.
And so you're an Irish Heart Foundation ambassador, you're an advocate for stroke support groups as well. Because, like, you know, they're terrible things, and I'd say there's no family in the country untouched by stroke, you know, or heart issues. If there's a message that you can get out, is there anything that the Irish Heart Foundation or people working with those suffering from strokes want to get out there to the public?
Well, I think it just is like that it is possible to overcome it. Like, if it's difficult, like, don't get me wrong, it's difficult. I might be putting like a cherry on the top here. Like, it's incredibly difficult, but it is possible with enough physiotherapy, enough occupational therapy, enough persistence, and especially support, like, with the right supports, it is possible to recover and to live a full life after stroke.
Yeah. What was your favourite day in athletics?
What was my favourite day in athletics? Ooh, that's a hard question. What was my favourite day in athletics? I think my favourite day in athletics was my last day in athletics. I'd say the last race I ran in Europeans, because I remember, say, I felt prior to the Europeans, I felt like, okay, I'm going to retire from athletics. And I guess that kind of took a pressure off or something. And I remember just being in the call room, and like, I was wearing my Irish jersey and I was my Irish singlet, and I was thinking, like, this is probably the last race I'm going to run for Ireland. I remember just thinking, genuinely, I am literally just going to go out there and I'm just going to enjoy this as much as I can, and I'm going to try my best, but it took a lot of pressure off me, and I've never ran with so carefree. Do you know what I mean? I was just like, I'm just going to go out here and give this a crack and see what happens. I think that probably is my favorite, my best memory.
Listen, Paul Keoghan, legend. Thanks, Mel.
Thanks, Mel, for having me. Cheers.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.